Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm coming to you live from, not live, really. Maybe a delay of about a day or two. I'm coming to you from the past, from the distant past. I'm coming to you from a hotel room in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where I'm out doing some work with an ad agency called Humanaut that I adore and think is full of creative and brilliant people. So I'm going to be interviewing on this podcast their creative director in the next few days. So look for that podcast in the weeks to come. Having a great time out here. Never been to Chattanooga. It's a sweet little town. Some rock climbing, a lot of red brick buildings. Went and saw some comedy last night. They even have a climbing gym. It's a nice little spot, but don't tell anyone. But yeah, I'm spending my week out here. It really does amaze me how easy travel is. And I mean, lives are busy. Travel can get expensive. I don't mean to like minimize that for anyone who can't travel, but just the fact that if you have a credit card and you build up points, you can basically travel for very cheaply all over the country. And all of a sudden, I'm halfway across the country in the South that afternoon. And just how you couldn't even explain that to someone in the distant past. You know, people who, Lewis and Clark and their company, just spending years walking one foot in front of the other over mountain ranges, deep in the snow, multiple seasons just to wind up somewhere that I can get to in about 4 hours. And it's cool. Like, culture is one of the most interesting aspects of our crazy species, and every town does it a little differently. So it's one of my favorite things to do. Just plop into a different town for a week and check it out. So that's where I'm coming from. Chattanooga, Tennessee. Digging it here. Beautiful place. This interview was with a really awesome author. Someone who I have known about for a while and recently got in touch with. Had no idea this entire time that I'd been reading his work that he lives in Santa Cruz, which is my hometown, and also surfs. That sport, it really is amazing how many surfers there are in the world. And Charles is a big idea guy. He takes really big ideas and he condenses them down into very manageable ideas. His first book, The Power of Habit, was a book that I read years ago, and that came up before James Clear's book Atomic Habits, which has exploded onto the scene as well. It's a lot of those same concepts that really can change your life. Concepts like, you know, humans should rely less on willpower and more on environment, more on making the things that you know are good for you easy to do. If you want to get into working out, don't rely on yourself to grind through and find your workout shoes in the morning and figure out what workout you want to do. No, pick what workout you want to do the night before and put your workout shoes next to your bed. Boom, you do that enough times, all of a sudden, you're in shape. So Charles is a big idea guy. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and author of multiple books, Power of Habit, which spent over 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list, Smarter, Better, Faster, which was also a bestseller, and his latest book, Super Communicators, which was just released and is maybe the most important book of them all. It is about communication. It's about how we can communicate better and how oftentimes we are talking past each other. Concepts like Are you having a logical conversation or an emotional conversation? You ever tried to speak logic to someone and it's just not getting through? Well, that's because you are having an they are in an emotional mindset and you're in a logical mindset. So there are a certain set of questions that you can ask yourself before trying to communicate with people that can really make things go better. And I think that language is maybe the most important invention humans have ever come up with. For sure, the most important invention we've ever come up with. For sure, actually. And improving our language skills, even in little bits on a daily basis, can change how people relate to you. It can open up opportunities and it can get you to think differently about things. Just as an example in this book, he talks about how super communicators, these are people who are just very good at communicating. One thing they share in common is that they tend to ask 10 times more questions than others. Asking questions, turns out, makes people open up. And I think that we don't ask questions nearly enough. So this was a talk about his book. We also talked quite a bit about his writing process. I selfishly asked him quite a bit about his reporting process for books, the way he organizes his research, and then the way that he is able to take these really big ideas and condense them down into bite-sized nuggets, bite-sized concepts, rather, within these big books. So we talked quite a bit about that, as well as our shared love of surfing. All right, I hope that you get a lot of out of this podcast. I sure did. Go buy his book, Super Communicators. It's out now. And please welcome to the podcast, Charles Duhigg.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part about Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
Script and everything before everyone shows up for the
very
for the
much
shoot.
So yes, yes,
okay.
But the secret that this ad agency has is they'll write a commercial, you know, well before, and they give it to the client, but then on shoot days they're constantly writing alt lines. So
gotcha.
If the joke doesn't land, they have 10 other ways to tell that story and shoot it. So it's a way of essentially, it's basically an insurance policy to make sure that your right. jokes will work if you have 10 others that.
So are you coming up with new, like you're on the set coming up with new jokes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it takes a week to make to shoot a commercial.
It depends on how many shoot days the client will book. But this is a 3-shoot-day commercial.
That's great. And it's just like a 30-second commercial,
30
right?
seconds, baby. Yeah, 30 seconds. But yeah,
that's
crazy. Just want to they want to cover so many angles. And the real expense of a commercial, a lot of it are on the shoot days because you need so many people on set, right? You know, the lighting people, the director, producer, creative director. Like, there's just so many heads usually.
I sort of always assume that they've chosen all the shooting angles. I mean, there's not that much narrative space there, right? Like it's 30 seconds and
no, it's probably. Yeah. But it's just the if you don't get it, it's so bad on the client side because there's so much money involved also just on the front end of coming up with all the ideas and then bringing them through. That yeah, it's they're usually. I mean, sometimes it'll just be one full day, but you would be amazed how much time and work goes into 30 seconds or 15 seconds
that's,
of
that's
airtime.
Super interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, man. I mean, I think that you're if you want to look at a really fascinating subculture, I know that you're. I glean that you write your books just so that you can kind of parachute into worlds that otherwise you may otherwise not be able to. the advertising world is fascinating. It is a lot of really creative people who are also really competitive. So there's just this crazy amount of like essentially trying to come up with as many insights as possible and then as many directions for that insight to take. So it is like a lot of comedians, but they're all in the room together trying to come up with the best possible ideas.
It's super interesting.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a good book that I recommend on advertising called Hey Whipple, Squeeze This. And it's kind of about how advertising agencies work from the copywriters to the directors to the creative directors. Yeah, Tim Ferriss recommends it often.
Hey Whipple, Squeeze This?
Hey Whipple, Squeeze This. Then it's a book about advertising agencies.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, it's nice to meet.
It's super nice to meet you, too. I've been...
you've been surfing lately?
I have been surfing. I was up in Santa Cruz when you were gone. I was at my sister's music performance. I always get my just guzzle surfing whenever I come to Santa Cruz because there, you know, you can surf there 360 days a year.
Yeah.
And
were you up at the Lane?
I was at the Lane. Yep. I was at the Lane's one of my favorite spots. And they actually, I don't know if you know this, but the cliff at the Lane broke off this past year. There was a big chunk that fell into the water. And a lot of people thought that it was going to ruin the wave because a lot of the surfers will take off right next to the Lane.
Yeah.
And it turned out to make the wave better. Yeah, so out there now there's this new big chunk of wave that kind of comes in and it creates what's called a wedge for surfers. And a wedge is basically like a slingshot. It's where two parts of the wall of the wave wedge together.
Right.
And then if you think about two energy forces kind of coming together at an angle, they supercharge each other. Right. And it's like two storms coming together at the same time, just on a micro scale.
There was definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was definitely because I don't surf the Lane, but I surf Cowles. And there was like after all those storms last year, there was like a new break, like something happened with the contours of the bottom of the seabed where like basically like a new break appeared at Cowles sort of further out. And then, you know, like it only lasted 2 or 3 months.
Sure.
And then it sort of got stopped working, but it was super interesting.
Well, it's probably all what happens is a lot of the sand will move down from its beach into the Lane, and it totally affects, you know, the bathymetry, right? There's topography in the mountains and bathymetry underneath the ocean. Yeah. And, you know, it totally determines what the wave will be like. Like the river mouth, as you might know, was the first wave ever surfed in the continental US.
And there's basically no wave there now.
There's no wave there anymore.
When I was reading Barbarian Days, like, and he's talking about surfing the river mouth, I was like that's crazy.
Yep.
It sounds like it was amazing.
It was an amazing wave, but the reason the river, and it was and it broke all year long because that river flowed out, the Hawaiian princes came over and the sand, the river moved the sand out, which then creates the wave on the bottom of the ocean, right? And makes this like peeling left, right. But then when the Army Corps of Engineers built the Santa Cruz Harbor, I believe it was in the 20s or 30s, they didn't anticipate that it would essentially block all of that sand from flowing south on Seabright Beach, which then shoaled over the river mouth and now makes it only break on the biggest rains of the year when that enough water breaks through.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's super interesting.
So how long have you been surfing?
About 10 years.
Cool.
Before we moved to Santa Cruz 3 years ago. And before that we lived in Costa Rica for a little while. And so we would surf Nosara, but basically I would surf like, you know, once or twice a year when we'd go down to Costa Rica. And then we moved there and we're surfing pretty regularly. And that was actually one of the reasons we moved to Santa Cruz, was just because it would give us a chance to surf more.
Yeah.
So it's great.
It's Surf City, man. I mean, it really is. The range of swells that come into Santa Cruz from north, you know, the ones that are spinning off the Kamchatka Peninsula, all the way the South Swells that come off of New Zealand, the Bay of Santa Cruz just takes it all in, which is rare. You know, most places in the world only get South Swells or North Swells.
So where do you surf in LA?
When I'm in LA, I surf Topanga a lot. I surf Malibu a lot. It is generally a lot smaller than Santa Cruz. Oh. LA has really good spearfishing.
Is it warmer?
Significantly warmer. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't have to wear a wetsuit.
You're wearing a wetsuit most of the year, but in the summer you can get into board shorts or, you know, a short arm wetsuit, which is nice. It's funny how now when I go back to Santa Cruz, I'm like, Jesus, this is so cold. Like,
yeah, I know. The wetsuit technology is so good though. I have to say, like, cause the first time I surfed was back, you know, in the like 90s.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, and like those things were so hard to put on, and that like you were still freezing cold in them. And now I use O'Neill suits.
Yeah.
And like now I put them on and I'm like, this is like I actually get hot in the suit when I'm surfing Santa Cruz because they're just so good.
I mean, it shows how much technology will change the trajectory of a sport, right? Before that, you could only surf for maybe half an hour. You know, the guys up in Ocean Beach would build bonfires on the beach and then go surf Ocean Beach and come in.
And your hands get so cold that like you can't really like move them anymore.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, hey man, I've known about you for a long time. I read The Power of Habit years ago, and I don't say this lightly, but it really did change my life in the context specifically of surfing. I started changing where I would, I started putting my wetsuit inside my room the night before I wanted to go surf early in the morning.
Oh yeah.
Cause after that book, I realized there's this moment when it's 5 a.m. and I, you know, the night before I plan, okay, I want to go surfing and my wetsuit is outside and it's freezing cold. And unless I have a friend who I'm going with, you know, the social aspect of habit change, I could just as easily go back to bed and just make an excuse. So it really did change the way I think about how I set up my environment. In a really profound way. So I had no idea you lived in Santa Cruz, but I did want to say that you really did have a big impact on my life when
thank you.
You know, 17, 18, and that habit that I initially applied to surfing has definitely, just that concept has stuck with me throughout my life as I'm getting into writing. And now, one of the reasons why I was so especially excited to talk to you is that I've been working on a book project about interviewing your parents, and it's a project that essentially posits that the more you learn about your parents through an interview process, it is this tool for self-exploration, and that by learning more about their story, it can help you fill in pages to your own book. So I've kind of used this as my own project of like wanting to interview my parents and learn more about their pasts and also dig into some of the conflicts that, you know, everyone has family baggage in one way or another. And those are often some of the hardest conversations to have. So I wanted to ask you about how you would apply super communicators to interviewing your parents. And specifically, you know, the question is, you know, how to go into a conversation with people who you know may trigger you?
Yeah, so I it's a really good question, an interesting one. The first most important step is having that realization, right? That like realizing that your parents are going to say things and you're probably going to react emotionally to what they're saying in ways that they don't intend or anticipate. And do you have kids yourself? Or are you married?
I don't, no.
Okay. So I will actually say this changes a lot when you have your own children, because you basically become much more empathetic towards your parents and you realize that what oftentimes seems like decisions they're making is really just them just basically trying to make it through the day and survive. But I think that the first thing is, you know, definitely sort of doing that. And then just having ways to call a timeout, right? So like one of the things that we know about what makes conversations better, hard conversations better, particularly conversations that are on difficult topics, is if we start them by saying, you know, this is going to be awkward and it's going to be uncomfortable and I might say the wrong thing and I'm going to ask you to apologize. I'm going to ask you to forgive me in advance. If you say the wrong thing, I promise I'll forgive you, right? To sort of lower the stakes. And then basically to like just sort of do some self-monitoring. And you could say something like, hey, look, if this is too much for me, I might need to take a minute, right? Or like when something comes up to say like, oh, that's interesting. Let me just take a second to think about that, just to help yourself calm down. There's this expression, if you're feeling furious, get curious.
Mm.
It's really, really good because what it basically says is when you're feeling upset, when you're feeling triggered, when you're feeling sort of hot under the collar, like the best thing you can do is to ask a question.
Right.
Because if nothing else, it's just going to kind of slow things down. Right. Like instead of you like being like, you're a jerk, you screwed me up. If you ask a question, it's going to seem less aggressive. And it also just might be that like you're misunderstanding what they're saying. Right. That your parents say something that for you, it seems like this big revelation and they're criticizing you. But from their perspective, they're like, no, 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 we didn't mean it that way. We were just literally telling you like where we went. Like why we went to Disneyland that year instead of
right.
Epcot.
But you didn't take right? me with you. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that like, you know, a key principle of being a super communicator is asking deep questions about our values or our beliefs and our experiences. And I think when it comes to talking to our parents, it can be really easy to stop asking deep questions and assume like it's their job to keep to carry the conversation along. But the truth of the matter is, like now that I have teenagers, like, you know, like your parents are basically just normal people, right? Like they also have long days. They get tired. You come home. They tell you that they want to hear about your day. But like if you're being boring and bratty, they don't actually want to hear about your day. They just like want to go like watch a TV show or have a drink. So I think the way to do it is like to kind of ask yourself, like, how would you talk to your friends? And my guess is with your friends, if they said something stupid, you'd be like, bro, can't believe you said that, right?
Right.
But you wouldn't get upset about it. You wouldn't take it like a personal insult. And I think the same kind of grace should be extended to our parents.
Mm, that's really good. Do you teach your teenagers how to ask questions?
Yeah. So we have this game we play where we haven't done it in a couple months, but when we're on vacation, we definitely do it, where we'll go to a restaurant and we'll order our food. And I tell them that they have to go and they have to talk to at least two strangers in the restaurant and like learn something about them and then come report back in order to eat their food. So it's kind of like, I mean, A, it's just nice because that way me and my wife can chat and the kids aren't like bothering us. But the second thing is like, you know, communication is a learned skill. Like nobody's born a good communicator. It's something that we practice and that we make into a habit. And so one of my big goals is to teach them how to ask questions. And we also play a game called Questions where they have to ask me a question. Like I'll ask them a question mm-hmm. and then they have to ask me a question and it can't be the same question I just asked them. And if I don't think that they're genuinely curious, then they have to ask a different question. And one of my sons is really, really great at it. He loves it. The other one is like, I hate this game. This is the worst game ever.
Right.
But like I make him do it because learning how to ask questions is a really valuable skill.
Right, right. One thing that you've talked about in Super Communicators is the power of humor, the power of like making a joke, an offering of just creating that connection. I forget who said it, but the line is a laugh is the shortest distance between two people, which I really believe. But I think that to the point of that. People aren't born good communicators. It's also just like humor is something that most people just don't practice. You know, either you're a kid on the schoolyard and people are like, oh, you're funny or you're not funny. But I think that humor and just question asking is something that people see as like as unchangeable as your eye color. But one thing that I really like about the way that you kind of orient towards life and kind of communicate is like, hey, no, these are all learned skills. These are things that you can get better at. Have you, since writing the book at all, practiced your humor at all? Do you find yourself making more bids for jokes and humor, knowing what a powerful skill it is?
Well, not, excuse me, not really. I mean, so one of the things that we know, there's a guy named, a professor named Provine, who's passed away now, but he spent his life basically studying laughter. And one of the things that he discovered is that most of the time when we laugh in a conversation, it is not in response to anything funny, right? It's not that someone's made a joke. It's not that someone's had a formal attempt at humor. It's that we laugh in order to show the other person that we want to connect with them. And when they laugh back, they're showing us that they want to connect with us as well. And so there's a real difference between trying to be funny and be humorous and laughing. And you can add laughter to almost any conversation. You know, like, I mean, next time you're in a conversation, just laugh at something that's like, laugh at something where it sort of makes sense to laugh, but nothing funny has been said. And I guarantee the other person will smile or laugh back, right? It's just it's a social instinct and it's a social sharing technique. That being said, you know, I think that sometimes it's our job to be funny and sometimes it's our job not to be funny. And you're exactly right. It's a learned skill. Like if you look for the humor, then you'll find it. And actually, if you look at the best comedians, they aren't necessarily the funniest people, right? Some of them are. Some are like just very like Robin Williams is just funny. He loves to entertain people. But you look at like, what's that guy's name? Nate Bargatze or whatever I mean, that guy is not like, he doesn't come off as the funniest human being on the face of the planet, right? Rather, he's focused on observations that are humorous and so he looks for the jokes and he finds them and he practices them and he polishes them.
Yeah.
But it's a way of looking at the world. It's not an innate skill.
Right. And when it comes to someone like Robin Williams, I think that one of his real tragedies was that he felt like he always had to be funny. You know, and people say that he felt like he always had to be on. And I'm sure we've all been around some of those people who are kind of exhausting to be around because they can't just slow down and mellow out. And my favorite comedians also are very likely not the funniest entertainers in group conversation, but they're so perceptive that they just find these little insights and nuggets and then work their asses off to figure out the exact right phrasing of it to create that perfect joke.
I think that's right. I think that comedy, much like writing, is really like a test of how much intelligence you have, right? And again, intelligence is not something that we're born with or born without. It's something that we train ourselves for. And the comedians that I like the most, like the writers I like the most, are the ones who sort of push themselves to say and observe something smart and new and original and interesting.
Right, right. Do you meditate?
Not a lot. Sometimes,
okay.
Like, but not a huge amount. Yeah. No.
I interviewed my dad, and one of his lines was, "Enlightenment sounds nice, but seems like a lot of work."
Yeah. Do you meditate?
I do, and the reason I was asking about it is because I found that some of the best communicators meditate. And I think that it speaks to something that you write about in your book, which is this ability to pause and take in what someone is saying without identifying or latching onto it immediately. I don't meditate all the time. I find that whenever I get into fights with my girlfriend, it's because I have not slept very well. And all of a sudden I'm taking what she's saying as I'm taking it personally. Right. And I'm attaching what she's saying to my identity. And meditation is sort of the practice of noticing your thoughts without attaching to them. And I have noticed that people who meditate a lot tend to be better communicators because they leave room for that little millisecond of space that allow them to take in the world and then respond rather than react.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think there's other ways to achieve that, right? So I think like when I was in high school, I debated a lot and in college. And if you sort of study rhetoric or you study debate, like one of the things that happens is that you have to be able to like argue on behalf of something and then immediately argue against it.
Mm.
And so it kind of, and this is a little bit true of journalism too. It teaches you that distance, the ability to take a step back and say like, okay, I'm going to analyze what you're saying based on what you're actually saying rather than, I also think it's just a product of frankly getting older. Like I think one of the things that happens is that as people, how old are you?
34.
Okay, 34. So yeah. So I think basically like, you know, second half of 30s and 40s, I'm 40, turning 49 this year. At some point, you just kind of learn who you are. And as a result, what people say to you is important and interesting, but it doesn't feel like they're actually, you don't care about their judgments quite as much, right?
Right, right.
Like, you know, and when my wife says like, you know, you did this thing or you like, you know, you hurt my feelings this way, I see it not as an attack on me, but like an observation. And I'm free to sort of say like, actually, like that's not what I intended. And maybe something else is going on, or saying like, oh, that like, I did not mean to do that. I'm sorry.
Right.
Right. Like, I think as we get older and we know ourselves more and more, the interactions become easier just because we have less to prove to ourselves about who we are, which is natural.
Right.
When you're in your 20s and early 30s, right? Like the truth is that like you're worried about how successful you're going to be. You're worried about like, do you actually have the skills and the time and the aptitude to be everything that you, to get from life what you hope that life will be. There's a lot of unknowns. And then at some point you kind of basically, the unknowns are solved.
Right.
And so as a result, you're in a place where you're not sort of observing yourself for evidence of success or unsuccess quite as much.
When you were young, did you set out to be a best-selling author? Was your like, was your drive like, I want to, and maybe not exactly that goal, but like, I want to become a known writer?
Not when I was young. So I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I went to Yale for my undergraduate, and then started a company in New Mexico. And after a couple of years of running the company, realized I needed to learn more. So I went to Harvard Business School to get an MBA. And it was midway through HBS that I decided to become a journalist instead of become a business person and go into politics. And so, you know, I think when you become a journalist, the goal is to be read, right? So there's a certain amount of sort of, I don't know if fame is the right word, but there's a certain amount of
notoriety,
attention,
yeah,
attention that you hope to attract,
yeah.
Because if you're writing stuff and nobody's reading it, then the writing activity is pointless. And then my wife got pregnant, and you know, we just didn't have very much money, and we were living in New York City, and it's tough to live there without money. And so I decided, like, I need to write a book to earn money. And I was working at the New York Times at that point, and so. So one of the goals with The Power of Habit was very deliberately to write a book that I thought a lot of people would enjoy and get real meaning from.
Right.
Because I needed to sell a lot of copies of them in order to, you know, buy a house and put my kids through school.
Mm-hmm. Did you, after that happened, I mean, but by all accounts, that was a very successful book. Did it feel the way you expected it to feel? And were there any aspects of having a book success that surprised you, both either a delightful surprise or a letdown of a surprise after having that experience?
Well, so I wouldn't describe it exactly that way. So the same year that The Power of Habit came out, 2013, is the same year that I won a Pulitzer Prize. And if you had asked me beforehand which one of those would have been life-changing, I would have said winning the Pulitzer Prize. And it turns out it's exactly the opposite. Like, winning a Pulitzer Prize is fun and awesome. And I'm really proud of the work we did and really pleased that it was recognized. But it doesn't really change your life. You're basically just getting a prize. Writing a best-selling book can change your life, right? And in fact, even if you don't want it to, it'll change your life just because there's so many new opportunities that are open to you that become incompatible with some of the ways that you spend time prior to writing that book. And so what I would say is what was surprising was just how, like, and very gratifying was how much people responded to it. Like, I still get emails every day from people who read The Power of Habit and say something like, you know, I felt like I had a problem with alcohol for 20 years. And then I read this book and I see a way out. And that's not really a testament to me. That's more a testament to the research that's been done that I was able to draw on and publicize. But that's been really, really satisfying and rewarding.
Mm.
So no, I wouldn't say there's been a huge amount, number of surprises, except, and this is true of any success. The thing about success is that we tend to focus on the day after the success happened, right?
Right.
The day that you have like a best-selling book, the day that you win the Pulitzer Prize, the day that, you know, your bank account exceeds $1 million. And the truth of the matter is that is one day in a lifetime. And there's thousands and thousands of days that come after that. And those days are much more important. And the thing about success is that it is wonderful to be successful. When you have success, that means that you have to do more of the activity that you've done that gives you that success. And so success is always a double-edged sword because, you know, if you run for Senate and you become a U.S. Senator, that's great. But then you have to be a U.S. Senator, and that's a lot of work, right? It's really hard. If you're a best-selling author, it's awesome. It's much better than being a non-best-selling author. But that means that there are certain obligations that you have, right? And one of those obligations is to probably write another book or to continue to interact with your audience. So success creates its own work. And the thing to figure out is, like, is it work that you enjoy doing even if you weren't a success, right? I really enjoy reporting and writing. So even if The Power of Habit hadn't done particularly well, it's an activity that I would continue to do very gladly.
Mm.
And it's important to figure out what you enjoy doing apart from the success, and then being prepared for the success when it occurs.
Right. The prize for eating the cake eating contest is more cake.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like, you have to be cool with wanting to eat more cake.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you, I'll, one thing that it seems that you are very talented at is finding ideas that are applicable to a wide range of people, finding these small stories, these colorful stories to be able to paint that idea, and then adding this kind of like three-step program to it, where I know that if I read one of your books, like, I could basically give it to anyone. There's going to be some interesting stories in it, but there's also going to be like a takeaway that I could take in 7 seconds flat, right? Like the cue routine reward, like, boom, okay, I get that. Did you recognize, I guess, A, am I missing anything in that aspect of your strength as a writer? Are there any other skills that you see as yourself as a writer? You're like, ooh, I'm actually good at this. I'm going to make sure to like use this tool in this book because other journalists don't have that. And yeah, I guess that's the question. And then the second is, do you kind of choose books because of your strengths like that?
Well, so it's a little bit different. So the things that you just mentioned, so you mentioned, you know, basically kind of like coming up with a concept, right? A topic that's widely applicable, finding narratives or stories that illustrate that in unexpected and kind of delightful ways, and then structuring it so that there's clear takeaways that are very practical and applicable to people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So all three of those are things that I do very, very deliberately that take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, take Super Communicators, for instance, probably has, it's like essentially eight chapters. So there's probably 15 stories in it. I probably reported 110 stories to find those 15. So there's a tremendous amount of work that you don't see on the page, but that means that I have 15 great stories. You know, I spent basically 2 years going through potential book topics with my editor before we landed on communication as something that we thought would be both rich enough and the data and the research being interesting enough, but also broadly applicable, right? Like, so what I'm not writing about is I'm not writing about parenting special needs kids. I'm not writing about how to become a great surfer. I'm not writing because all of those things just have limited audiences.
Right.
And for the types of books I like to write, I want there to be a lot of people who it occurs to them to pick up the book. And then figuring out how to create these takeaways, you know, that's a little bit of a different skill, but it's just as much of a skill because oftentimes, you know, the takeaways all come from science. Like it all comes from experiments that have done and research that's been done. But the thing is, if you read academic papers, it's oftentimes very difficult to see how to make the concept that's discussed in an academic paper or the finding that they've had into something that I can repeat in 7 seconds and that is applicable in people's lives.
Sure.
And so a lot of that is literally just thinking about, you know, like what are they saying in this paper? How do I take the idea that they're saying in this paper and make it something that feels vital and usable and engaging? And so the three things that you mentioned, those are three really core elements of books. None of them happen naturally or easily, right? They're very much things that I go out and I do the work in order to be able to do those things.
Right. Can you give me an example of a research insight that you found that you then had to turn into a quick takeaway for super communicators?
Yeah. I mean, so there's a bunch of research that's been done on asking questions and there's these questions that are known as deep questions. But in the literature, deep questions are actually kind of amorphous, right? And so like you say deep questions and people kind of know what you're talking about, but it's all over the place how they use it in the literature. Like what is deep? What is not deep? When does a question become deep? And so I basically looked at like 40 or 50 papers that had looked at question asking. And the thing that I saw emerge was the questions that seem to be deep are questions that ask people about their values or their beliefs or their experiences. Now, there is no one paper that says that, right? There's no one paper that says, like, this is the definition or the criteria for a deep question. But if you read enough papers and you think about it hard enough, it becomes clear that this is something that they all have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we define deep questions, as something that asks about someone's values, beliefs, or experiences.
Right.
You know, similarly, for the power of habit, there's this idea of the keystone habit, right? One habit that sets off a chain reaction and changes other patterns in your life. That phrase, keystone habit, that is not a phrase that was ever used before I wrote that book. But it captures an idea that many, many papers mentioned in many different ways, which is that, you know, there's this, that when you start, that for some, in some cases, when you start a small pattern shift, it has a cascading effect. And so a lot of it is just sitting down and trying to figure out, like, how do we describe this in a way? There's, you know, 15 papers I've read who all say variations of the same thing. What do they have in common? And what's a pithy way of framing that so that it's easy to remember?
Mm-hmm. And an example of a deep question might be, what got you into filmmaking? Like something.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Why, if you meet someone who's a doctor.
Yeah.
And instead of asking them like, where do you practice medicine? Asking them, why did you decide to go to medical school? Or what do you love about being a doctor?
Right.
Right. You're asking someone about not the facts of their life, but how they feel about their mm-hmm. life. And so that makes it easier to remember how to do it.
Right. That's great. When you're trying to consolidate these big heady ideas down into something that someone like me can understand, do you communicate them around the dinner table? Like I'll try and, as far as like stories that I think will be interesting for articles or stories for my book, I find that one thing that's really helpful is just telling a friend about it and noticing their reaction as I'm trying to convey the concept and see if they think there's something funny or interesting or they lean in or not.
I think that can be really valuable. So in my case, I don't do it with friends or my family just because like I'm doing it all the time, but I have a very formal process that I go through with my editor. So I'll do a ton of reporting. And while I'm doing that reporting, I'm oftentimes sharing ideas that I've heard in the last interview with the person I'm talking to right now and kind of seeing if they think it's interesting and where it takes them. And then what I'll usually do is I'll create a bunch of index cards with all the details. And then I'll just write a letter to my editor. And that letter is oftentimes, you know, the chapter is basically 8,000 words long. That letter is often 4,000 to 5,000 words long. But it's something where I don't care about the writing. I'm explaining to him what I've learned and how I think it'll work in a chapter. And then he comes back and he says, like, this part is interesting and this part doesn't really line up for me. And this just seems boring or seems like too much. So yes, there's a big iterative process. I think as you become more established as a writer, you basically have people who get paid to do that instead of making your friends do it.
Yeah.
Which is good, because at some point if it's interesting to your friends, that's great. But like, what you really want is you want it to be interesting to someone who's paid to think about whether it's interesting to millions of people.
Do you know who does it for me?
Who's that?
Pam Higgins.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Pam's great, right? Yeah. Pam's an editor.
Yeah.
She does it really, really well.
I had dinner with Pam last week, and she's like, do you know Charles Duhigg? I'm like, I'm interviewing him next week. Small freaking world.
I got to go see her. Like, she and Steve were at, her husband, Steve Hawk, were at my wedding.
Yeah.
And I basically haven't seen them in like 20 years, and I live 40 minutes from them. I got to go hang out with them.
Yeah. They're amazing. Just a couple more questions. I want to be respectful of your time, but this has been so awesome. When you are reporting for a book like this, do you have any reporting systems that you found to be really useful? Of like, okay, step one, step two, step three. I mean, you said just knowing like the cue card thing was really interesting, and that then you send it to your editor. In the steps before that, so you reach out to someone who's, you know, the head of the NRA and the head of an anti-gun rights organization, and you want to figure out like, okay, can we get these two people together? Or you know of some experiment that's happening that could be interesting for super communicators. What does that process look like? Is it you're just looking at like Googling articles at first and then finding the people that...
I'm pulling a lot of academic papers.
Okay.
And I'm reading those papers, and then I'm writing to the person, to the first author on them, and saying, can I talk to you about your work? And oftentimes my question is some variation on, I want to prove to them that I've read their work, and I've usually read pretty much close to everything that they've written. But then I say like, look, I know your work really well, but I don't know enough about this to actually even understand what the right question to ask you is. Like, what do you think is the important part of your work? Like, what's the big takeaway? Right. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get them to think on my behalf. I'm trying to get them to, they know what's interesting about themselves better than I know what's interesting. And I'll give them a lot of guidance and shaping where they say like, oh, I'm not interested in, you know, this part of it that you're talking about, but I am really interested in about this other part. What you don't want is, you don't want a situation where you're just this is for writing interviews. Podcast interviews are different, but you don't want a situation where you're just asking questions and they're just answering your questions. What you really want them to do is to tell you what questions you ought to be asking, because the most interesting stuff probably won't occur to you. So those are often very, very free form, very oftentimes frustrating conversations, because people like to be asked direct questions and they like to say things that they've already said before. But if they've already said it before, I probably already know it because I read some paper, listened to some podcasts that they did. So what I do is, and I'll do literally hundreds and hundreds of interviews, right, for a book or for a piece for The New Yorker, you know, anywhere from 40 to 150 interviews. And then I take, and at that point, I'm starting to think about what the chapter should look like. I'm starting to think about the structure.
Sorry, are you interviewing them? Is it usually like 1 hour interviews over Zoom recorded? How do you?
Actually, I don't really prefer Zoom. I like over the telephone. So I'll just call them. Yeah, for an hour.
And then notes on your computer while you're doing
I'm
that?
I'm taking notes on my computer. I'm oftentimes recording it and not recording it, but using AI to auto transcribe it.
Got it.
But taking notes is essential because the transcripts are really, really boring to read.
Right.
And it's the act of taking notes that lets you... that helps you understand the important part of what they're saying. You need to be processing what they're saying to you as they're saying.
Because you're perking up. You're like, oh, that's interesting. So are you writing that on your computer while you're on the phone?
You mean, I'm literally just transcribing what they're saying to
while on the phone. Okay.
Yeah, well, on the phone.
Okay.
And then, so what I do is I print up all of those interviews. I go through and I read and I underline and I write notes in the margins about the various ideas. And then I take a huge stack of index cards and I just write each idea or each fact or each element gets its own index card. And usually that leaves me with, like, you know, for a chapter, anywhere from 250 to 700 index cards. And then what I do is I put them into piles, sort of like, you know, this belongs with this and this belongs with this, fully aware that, you know, half the piles are going to get thrown out. And when I actually write the chapter, you know, I'm going to use 100 index cards of the 700 and the rest of them just get jettisoned. But that's the point. A lot of writing is about not only figuring out what to say, but figuring out what you don't need to say or what's distracting. And so once I put those cards into piles, that's when I sit down, I put them to the side and I just write like a free form letter to my editor. And usually at that point, and we'll go back and forth on that letter and he'll say, this part's boring or this doesn't make any sense. And usually by the time we're done with that, I kind of know what the chapter is going to look like. And then I just have to write it.
So good. So good. This is,
it's a long process, yeah. But it pays off.
Totally. I mean, I grew up as, you know, an athlete. I wanted to be a pro surfer. When I was younger, I found that I was not particularly naturally talented at surfing. And it was a really frustrating thing for me to see people who just kind of got it right away. And I found that the concepts of making anywhere that I could leverage a certain skill or leverage my environment or find a mentor and just do these little things added up to create real changes in a pretty major way. And yeah. A lot of my life now, I mean, I'm on my first book, is about trying to figure out what those systems are that can allow me to just not get so overwhelmed with the process. Yeah. And Pam and Steve are just amazing at that. But just so you know, that was an incredibly useful piece of information, just as the power of habit was to surfing, to this process I'm in right now as a writer. So thank you.
And the key is to, like, you know, my process changes all the time, right? Like the key is to sort of figure out, like, ask yourself, is this working for me? Is this not working for me? And you're right. A big part of writing a book is getting to a place where you're working on a chapter or you're working on half a chapter, yeah, or you're working on the introduction to a chapter. You don't, it's like eating an elephant, right? You just do it one bite at a time. Yeah. And so the thing is that, like, and you need to keep sort of the whole book in mind, right? Because a book is an entity that is different from just seven newspaper or magazine articles stapled together. But it's okay to let yourself forget about the book for a little while and think about this one thing that's in front of you.
Mm.
And honestly, I discovered this with my second book. Like, if you just sit down at a computer enough days in a row, you're going to end up with a book on the other side.
Yep.
It's just a matter of making yourself sit down and do the work. And I apologize. I have to jump.
I know. This was so great. I really appreciate your time. And this was just an awesome interview. And would love to take you surfing anytime.
Let's do it. That'd be really fun.
All right, cool. Congrats on the book. It's wonderful.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Take care.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.